You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial, or streaming at 3cr.org.au, or if you're on the go this early in the morning on the Community Radio Plus app. It's Monday, the 4th of August, 2025. I'm Rob, and for the next 90 minutes, we'll be bringing you a selection of segments from across the radical left world. We're going to start the show off by speaking with Tom Studens from the Unemployed Workers Union. We're going to be talking about a ruling from the federal court two weeks ago, which declared that the previous method to calculate welfare debts, known as income apportionment, was unlawful. So to unpack this very complicated ruling and what it means for people who are on welfare, I'm going to be speaking to Tom Studens at about 7:15, and following that, we're also going to be speaking with an activist who has just attended a big canopy campout with the Bob Brown Foundation in Tasmania's Central Highlands. It was a forest protest that happened with community members rallying to challenge native forest destruction in logging areas to stop those efforts and to stop our precious native forest being destroyed. So that interview is coming at 7:30. At 8 o'clock, we'll be hearing a regular segment that we play on the first Monday of every month here on the Monday Breakfast Show from our comrades over at the Commons Social Change Library called Tiny Sparks and Turning Points. They'll be bringing us a bulletin featuring some radical events over the years that changed the continent of so-called Australia. So that's coming at 8 a.m. And we'll also hear part of an interview that Marissa from the Doin' Time show did last Monday with Ilo Diaz, who's from the Center Against Racial Profiling. And yeah, they had a fabulous interview speaking about Victoria Police's ever-expanding powers, as well as the shooting of Abdi Fattah Ahmed in Footscray a few months back. The interview gives some really good context in the racist violence that led to Abdi Fattah's death. And he also talks about, the expansion of police powers and sort of the mechanisms with which that happens here in so-called Victoria. And, we're also potentially going to have a live cross with someone regarding the demolition of public housing towers, which is happening, right now. Works are still continuing. Comrades are actually encouraged to to go down there and help support the effort to stop the demolition works from happening. That's happening at 120 Racecourse Road in Flemington. There's a picket that's set up there right now. And your support would very much be needed, and it would be helpful. So yeah, if you can make it down there, then please do so. In the meantime, let's do some news headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty.
And you've just heard a little segment of Nitty Gritty from Shirley Ellis, which means that it's time for our news headlines for Monday, the 4th of August. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. Israeli forces have killed at least 92 people across Gaza on Sunday, including 56 people seeking aid. Gaza's health ministry says a further 6 Palestinians have died of forced starvation and malnutrition, bringing the confirmed number of starvation-related deaths to at least 175. Of course, unofficial numbers would be much, much higher. Back here in so-called Australia, activists and supporters of Palestine have showed up in the thousands across Sydney and Melbourne yesterday to protest against the Australian government's complicity in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. With calls to sanction Israel now, stop arming Israel, to lift the siege on Gaza, expel the Israeli ambassador, and end the genocide, the people have showed up in solidarity as the death toll continues to rise from starvation. In Naam, it was the 93rd consecutive Sunday that people have rallied together to march for justice. The Free Palestine rally in Naam yesterday saw thousands march from the State Library to the King Street Bridge with the aim of bringing attention to the forced starvation tactics being utilized by Israel on the Palestinian population. As per the Free Palestine Coalition Naam, the march to the bridge was planned in solidarity with the Gadigal communities who marched to the Sydney Harbour Bridge yesterday. Organisers requested that protesters and supporters bring pots and pans to make noise about Labour government's inaction to bring sanctions to Israel in organised efforts to change the status quo. With over 1,200 Palestinians killed while seeking aid at Gaza Humanitarian Foundation checkpoints, men, women and children remain severely malnourished. Yesterday's rally in Naam had speeches from Ranim, the MC, a Palestinian student and activist, Tasnim Samak from the Free Palestine Coalition Naam, Samantha Ratnam, a former leader of the Victorian Greens, Basil Al-Ghatis, a Palestinian engineer and activist, and Zain Barini, who is an 8-year-old with a big heart and a strong voice for justice. Also in news this week, a harmful algal bloom crisis is threatening marine ecosystems and oceans of the coast of South Australia. According to the Australian Marine Conservation Society, distress to underwater ecosystems is turning once thriving areas barren. With 1,400 square kilometers of ocean up to depths of 30 meters, facing turmoil from rising sea temperatures of up to 2.5 degrees and heat waves caused by climate change. Nutrient-rich runoffs from river catchments are distressing local communities of divers, scientists, fishermen, and related community industries. According to the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, an algal bloom occurs when, quote, toxin-producing algae grow excessively in a body of water, end quote. The impacts of harmful algae blooms, quote, can damage the environment by depleting oxygen in the water, which can kill fish and other living creatures. Harmful algal blooms that bloom near the water surface can also block sunlight from reaching organisms deeper in the water, end quote. And those are your news headlines. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show for Monday, the 4th of August, 2025. Stay tuned.
The state government has sold 578 hectares of public land to private developers. They're building private-public partnership model housing over public housing land, and it's just not on.
Housing is just massively expensive. It's never been effective in this country to rely on the market to provide decent housing for people.
Rent has risen by 21%. That's median rent across the country as of January this year.
As the rents keep rising, so must we. And we must stand together as a collective, because this war cannot be won by the few. It will only be victorious by the many.
3CR. Stay tuned. Stay radical.
Be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. Will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lights of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our land.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That song you heard before those announcements there was, of course, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised by Gil Scott-Heron. A recent ruling from the federal court means that the federal government will need to recalculate more than $4 billion worth of debts owed to the Department of Social Services. The ruling from the case Chaplin versus Secretary Department of Social Services declared that the previous method to calculate said debts, known as income apportionment, used since the early 1990s, was unlawful. To help us understand the ruling and its implications, the Monday Breakfast Show is now joined by Tom Studenz from the Unemployed Workers Union, a welfare rights advocate whose independent coverage has been recognised by the Robodebt Royal Commission. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much. Well. Obviously, this ruling is super complicated. I just wanted to check that description of it was accurate.
That's pretty good. 7:15 in the morning, if I'm being brutally honest with you.
Thank you so much.
I spend a lot of my time reading this stuff and have done for a few years now. Prior to that, I was on Centrelink myself, which is how you get into this sort of thing most of the time. And it's a bit of a pickle. If you've heard any of the politicians try and speak about this, they're not much help. Mm. But essentially, if you can comprehend what robo-debt was, that was basically taking a year of your income and slicing it up evenly across 26 fortnights of the year. This apportionment was basically to do that with a smaller time frame within days, meaning that if you had earned money in 1 week, it could be applied to the previous week. It was quite ropey. The department says that they stopped doing that around 2020, which is quite convenient as all debt raising was suspended during COVID. So they hadn't been doing any debt raising. And then the Robodebt Royal Commission happened. And during that process, Services Australia is what they're called now. Used to be Department of Human Services. They run Centrelink and Medicare. So they came clean to the Commonwealth Ombudsman during the Robodebt Royal Commission that they'd actually been unlawfully calculating debts a different way for even longer. It's just that they weren't doing that quite so deliberately in this case, although, what does it really matter for the person at the end of that debt letter? They just figured out that it was illegal before everyone else did in this case. And they said, we're not doing it. And then during the Robodebt Royal Commission, they were like, actually, we want people to know that we're not doing this anymore and that we're going to recalculate these debts. And so it's important to say that a lot of robo-deaths were partially calculated using this method, like apart from the fact they were robo-deaths. These are deaths that, as you said, extend into the 90s, and there's some evidence that they extend even further back. So we get to this Matthew Chaplin, who had a debt that was calculated by apportionment, and so he appealed that debt to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal at the time, now called the Administrative Review Tribunal, and they gave a pretty ropey decision. The Appeals Tribunal is the members that, as your listeners may be aware, that part of the reason the old tribunal was abolished was that it was stacked with Liberal Party apparatchiks, etc. But sufficient to say that tribunals often have people with varying legal qualifications on it. There's some people like me who don't have a law degree at all. And in this case, they came up with some pretty loopy stuff like, you know, you count people's income at the time that they get paid, not when they work. That's when they become entitled to the income for the purpose of social security law. I'm pretty sure they just came up with that off the top of their head. Right? Like, they didn't seem to have tried to support that with employment law, or obviously that's been thought about. So that was one of the reasons it was appealed. And so it was like the department used a particular method to try and recalculate Mr. Chaplin's debt, which is what they were doing with these apportionment debts. So Centrelink, everyone accepts that those were illegal, right? This is about how they're recalculating it. And the contention here was that they were doing that in a way that was also illegal. But the federal court has accepted the department's formulation of the law, which is a very intriguing decision, which has some pros and cons, but effectively means that the department can go and just use that method to recalculate all these debts far back into the past as they want, really, which is not amazing. And that can be a legal way for them to sort out these many, many, you said it relates to $3 or $4 billion in public money, right? Like, so they think, hey, we've got a good method. We're going to go and grab these things now. Tanya Plibersek, the new social services minister, gave an interview last week where she sounded pretty set on that. And it was some stuff that she did back in the Gillard government that is part of the reason we're in this mess. But basically, the federal court did something quite novel in that they actually decided the case. Now, with a tribunal case, and the dissenting opinion from Kenneth Jay, the 2-1 decision, sort of said, like, I don't know why you're doing that, because the act that regulates appeals to the federal court says that we shouldn't really be doing that. It should be confined to questions of law, not to actually decide cases, and then you meant to send it back to the tribunal. So that would avoid the situation where, like I said, basically the court has given the okay to read the Social Security Act in this way and go after these debts. It's arguable they didn't need to do that, but it's where we are now, and that's kind of a problem for everyone.
What does this ruling mean for people who are on welfare and, you know, and are obviously frustrated for that the government has been, you know, acknowledging that, you know, a few years ago that this method was unlawful and is only now, because of the federal court's ruling, have to change it, right?
Well, no, they accepted it was unlawful. This is just a way of them trying to still get at the money. That's the issue, is that there's still this concept, as in RoboDebt, that, you know, you got to get the money off these people. You got to shake the welfare recipient population down. And like I said, a lot of these debts were also RoboDebt. So they were calculated unlawfully twice. And where they've said that they are going to recalculate it, that obviously means correspondence with the department, people reliving old traumas, people having to go back and contact old employers. These are all features of RoboDebt, and they're all things that were known to be very unfair about RoboDebt. And the thing that people suspect will make that all go away is by implementing one of the RoboDebt Royal Commission recommendations. It's actually quite a good recommendation. When the coalition government was implementing RoboDebt, they passed a law that says Social Security recipients are exempt from the ordinary statute of limitations on debt recovery, right? So most states have similar like limitations, about 6 years. In New South Wales, it's 6 years for any debt. After that, you can't get it, right? But welfare recipients have a different rule. The law is different for people who claim Centrelink because of RoboDebt, and also to make RoboDebt happen. And so that was a very key recommendation of the Royal Commission, because that's the law that made it possible to go back and collect all these old debts, which is now what is being like relitigated, essentially. It's like Centrelink is saying, hey, we buggered up collecting these debts since the 80s. Could we have another crack, please? And the Federal Court of Australia has taken the position that, yes, you can. And I'm not so sure about that, because there are actually quite a lot of practical concerns.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure there's many. I mean, I feel like this will is obviously, if, as you were saying, you know, the debts go all the way back to the 80s. I mean, it's going to take them a long time to figure out how much, you know, is actually owed or whatever. And
there's such discrete calculations, Rob. You're going in, you're going down, like, day-to-day people's employment histories from 40 years ago, possibly.
Wow.
30 years ago, 20 years ago. And that obviously disadvantages welfare recipients, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because it means that it's, and this was talked about in the decision and in the dissent, and also in a number of lots of commentary about it. Not enough commentary, but basically, like, it just means that your position as a welfare recipient is the less evidence you have, the weaker your case is. If they just pick a point in your past. You can pick a point in anyone's past and ask them to account for anything, and they'd have a lot of trouble doing it. So I don't think doing that hundreds of thousands of times, and what the department says is the average variance in these debts is going to be like $300. But the cost administratively to go and do that is going to be astronomical. And I don't think it can actually be done by the current welfare system that we have, in terms of staffing and capacity, in terms of IT system. There's so many problems with all of it. And it's important to note that the Department of Social Services, who have charge of the legislation in the welfare system, so that's why they were the respondent in this case, they put out quite a triumphant statement. It's like, yeah, we're going to go get the debts now. it's not that easy. It's actually very, very hard. And to the point where you shouldn't do it. Like, if those debts are varied down by $100, if we say they're $300 average, then the law says that debts under $200 should be waived by the secretary for the reason of they're not economical to pursue. It costs too much. To get a welfare debt, you have to pay a public servant a number of hours. You actually have to pay several of them working in several different teams to do that. So,
yeah, so you can imagine that trying to recalculate those debts would be You know, if they're averaging $300, it might not even be worth it, you know?
What's the point? And Tanya Plibersek said, like, the character of Furamax was, like, well, but it's fairly owed to the government, and we have to get it, because the law says we have to get it. It's like, there are more things to think about than that, aren't there? Like, DSS is very triumphant. It's like, the Robodebt Royal Commission, I thought we'd all sort of accepted that just saying, hey, this is technically legal, is not a very high bar for policymaking or public administration. Like, just because a court can't stop it doesn't mean it's a good idea. It certainly doesn't mean it's worthy of Labor government to be doing this. It's such a completely undignified for everyone involved. That's what I mean. There's problems for everyone. When the fact that it's come to a court to make some quite interesting law about this is because the government doesn't know what to do. Like, I can't put it more simply than that, unfortunately.
Right.
They feel trapped by this political imperative, which drives everyone in this stuff, that welfare recipients have money for us. That money can go on the budget bottom line, and we can point at that and say, hooray, while obscuring all the spending that goes into recovering that money. Like, it's extremely Robodebt-like. It's the same sort of attitude. It's not that the scheme itself is similar. People are very sensitive to Robodebt comparisons, but I really have some theories as to why. But, yeah, the Albanese government can barely explain any of this to a journalist, so
yeah,
they tap out whatever the, it's like, oh, apportionment, oh, that's really hard, we don't have, you wouldn't understand that.
Yeah, and I think the complexity is what stops people from sort of touching it, right? I'll just remind listeners that we are speaking with Tom Students from the Unemployed Workers Union about a ruling from the federal court a few weeks ago, which declared that the previous method to calculate welfare debts, known as income apportionment, which has been used since the early 1990s, was unlawful. Yeah, so we only have a few minutes left of the interview, Tom, unfortunately, but maybe you just like to talk about, yeah, the coverage of this in general. I feel, you know, as we've mentioned several times in the interview, this topic is obviously very complicated. And do you think that, yeah, I'm just wondering to get your thoughts on, you know, like how many, like most of the perspectives on this are from an academic perspective, right? And there's not many voices being spoken to from people who are actually receiving welfare, right?
There never is. Like, being someone who was on welfare and has been trying to get these things in the media for so long, you got to do it all yourself, and no one's going to help you. it's really bad. There was an excellent piece, though, by Christian Amiette in The Australian, who herself had a Robodebt. She did a really, really, really good job. I really suggest to your readers to try and, like, don't expect everyone to have an Australian subscription, but there are ways of doing these things. I hope that's okay to say in public. But basically, she's just saying, like, we want Robodebt to never happen again. That's what everyone's been saying the whole time. That's the whole point of having a royal commission. Well, how about changing one of the laws that actually made it possible? And the thing with this federal court decision is that if the Albanese government had just taken that very simple recommendation on board to just repeal this Robodebt-specific law that made Robodebt possible, take them no more than, I don't know, 2 weeks to get it through Parliament. Could have been smashing the Liberals the whole time. Yada, 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 yada. Like, there's literally no reason not to repeal it. The Department's done no work on that. And so it just defaults to, well, it's all going to fall on welfare recipients again.
Hmm.
And we shouldn't even be having to have this conversation, because if the government were like honest and legitimate and realistic about what a response to robo debt looks like, well, they had their opportunity to implement this. And but now, like, if they do it now, that's great. Don't get me wrong, right? If this is the reason they take to be like, oh, recalculating all those debts in a really technically finicky way that's going to cost us a lot of money. The department's already advised us that this is quite a risky undertaking. Okay, this is on our table. Let's just implement this. Let's move on. And, like, the federal court's time doesn't get wasted, and we don't have all these new, like, precedents to have to... Like, none of this had to actually happen. That's what's so disappointing about it.
Yeah.
The actual rights of welfare recipients are the very last thing anyone thinks about. There are even a couple of lines in the decision that I thought were just kind of rude to welfare recipients, sort of implying that the applicant was treating this as a kind of a lottery and that you get an extra couple hundred bucks out of it or whatever. That's how institutions think of welfare recipients in Australia. It's how politicians think of it. It's kind of divorced from reality by a long way. And this is, unfortunately, reality catching up with a government that is happy to say the right things about welfare debt recovery. They've done a couple of decent things. We don't have private debt collectors hounding people anymore. But there are so many issues with debt recovery across the spectrum. We haven't even touched, like, apportionment. Obviously, yep. There's secondary effects.
Yeah.
They had to pause a whole bunch of family tax benefit debt. Now, the way that family tax benefit is calculated...
Tom, we've got about 30 more seconds of this interview, unfortunately. I've got, another guest waiting. So, I'll give you 30 more seconds to say what you need, and then we'll have to let you go.
Well, it's a very simple, like, the Albanese government has a choice to implement this Robodebt Royal Commission recommendation. It's very simple. They should just do it. And it gets them out of trouble, and it gets everyone out of trouble. It gets the department out of trouble. It gets welfare recipients out of trouble. It makes them look less bad than otherwise. It's just the best solution for everyone. And it's about time, like, good public administration, care for welfare recipients is in the foreground, and not just in speeches to public servants behind closed doors. That's what I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you again for helping us to unpack this on the show. And we'll keep an eye on it to keep talking about this. Thank you so much for joining us, Tom.
Thanks, Rob. Happy to do so anytime.
Thank you.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR on 8:55 AM. My name's Ed Meat. I made it into the show late this morning, but it's nice to be here. Up next, I will be interviewing an activist who is locked on to machinery and a gate down in Tassie recently to stop native forest logging. Following a big canopy campout with the Bob Brown Foundation in Tasmania's Central Highlands, a forest protest has happened with community members rallying to challenge native forest destruction in logging areas. In the efforts to stop the logging, Moggy, who we've got on the line with us now, has halted logging for 3 days by locking on. And, good morning, Moggy. How are you going?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for taking the time on a Monday morning to come on the show with us.
That's all right.
Do you want to tell us and the listeners, do you want to fill us in and give us a little bit of the context around what's going on down in Tasmania, Lutra Weedum?
The logging that's happening in Tassie is kind of happening like all over the island. It's thought to be like some of the like the fastest and the some of the worst logging that's kind of happening in the world, I believe. Like they're doing it super quickly. And yeah, the scale of it is really, really huge. And they're predominantly, like a lot of, at least in the Central Highlands, where I was in Waikai, we're in New Country, the primary sort of use of the logs that are being cut down is just for chipwood. So they're just turning it into chip and... exporting it around the world. I think a lot of it goes to China. So really, really doesn't seem like a very good reason to be chopping down really big trees. Some of them are 900 years old.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's also nothing new, sadly, but it's an ongoing fight. And like you said, I read in a few of the posts as well regarding down in Tassie and Lutra Weedum, some of the native forests there are sort of like the last bastion in a way.
Yeah. It's like the forests there are really fundamental to the conservation of ecosystems, and a lot of species are becoming threatened because of the logging.
I believe Australia is, don't quote me on this, but I believe we're third for deforestation globally.
Yeah, they were. I learned a lot about what was going on whilst I was down there. So all of it's kind of, fresh knowledge, but they did talk a lot about the foresting there being some of the worst in the world at the moment. Just in terms of, like, speed and scale of the destruction, it's one thing to sort of see pictures of it, but being there and seeing it is, something else. It kind of, doesn't really compare to, seeing a picture.
Well, I think it's incredibly brave that you've put yourself and your body on the line to protect these trees, and takes a special caliber of human to have the courage to stand up for something that's so much greater than them, but also inclusive of all of us. So well done, Moggy.
Thank you. Yeah, it's kind of feels like a last resort. You know, you can donate money and protest and, speak up for what you believe in, but they're sort of, unfortunately, they keep going. So going there and kind of putting your body between them and the trees is like a last resort. And they need as many people as they can to do it. So it's a very inclusive organisation, and it's, definitely an available experience for anybody who's, keen to get involved.
Yeah, nice. I've seen up on the coast in New South Wales, I've also got a fair bit of logging going on in native forest areas that community is standing up for, but I suppose all around Australia in different parts, I'm not too sure about other states, but... for the community call out for down in Tassie, how can people get involved? Like, what are some links for the listeners that they can look to and, to find more information? And if it does feel the calling to go down to Tassie and stand up for against logging actually does feel right, like it has for you?
Yeah, so the Bob Brown Foundation website has generally got all of the information that you need. I believe they often post, like it's called like a camp out or a base camp. And so they'll often just post the dates and, yeah, you can go and meet people and get involved and, yeah, kind of go from there.
Yeah, sick. What country did you say it was on before? And are there any elders down there that are part of the movement?
What was the first part, sorry?
What country is it down there in Lutruwita?
The area that I was.
Or? Yeah.
Yeah, so Waikaremu country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah, just sort of the Central Highlands area. There is a few elders, Tiprasana, who I met while I was down there, I believe was an elder, and Uncle Jim,
mm-hmm.
Who I didn't get the chance to meet while I was down there. But Uncle Jim has been arrested in one of the coups that I was kind of at one point. And, yeah, a big part of Uncle Jim's movement is, you know, that it's not the country. The country doesn't belong to sustainable timber Tasmania. And that, so basically what they say when you're there is that you're trespassing and, you know, you're not allowed to be there. But, Uncle Jim's... movement is it's very much his country, which is the truth. The country was stolen from Palawa Pakana people. No consent's been given for the destruction that's taking place on the country.
Mm.
It's really important to highlight that and, stand up against that because deforestation is just like an ongoing tool of colonization. It's very much severing Indigenous people's connection with country, which is super important.
Moggy, that's all we've got time for this morning. Was there one or two last points that you wanted to add in before we finish?
I don't think so. I think I've sort of said everything I need to.
Well, I'm inspired by your courage once again, and thank you for leading the way with taking direct action on these topics and issues. And I suppose it is important for people to get involved because these forests won't be there forever.
Yeah, especially if we don't sort of stand up against it. So, yeah, as many people that can get involved is really important.
I hope you have a beautiful day, Moggy. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Bye.
She got
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio. This is the Monday Breakfast Show for Monday the 4th of August. Now we're going to hear an excerpt of an interview from last week's Doin' Time show, in which host Marissa speaks with Ilo Diaz from the Center Against Racial Profiling. And in this excerpt, they're providing context about the shooting of Abdi Fattah Ahmed in Footscray a few months back. The interview also speaks a little bit about the Center Against Racial Profiling and, Ilo's history in advocacy for human rights.
Now, I'm wondering if you could just start off just introducing yourself and speaking a little bit about the Center Against Racial Profiling.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that really lovely, warm introduction. Yeah, so I'm Ilo Diaz. I was born in Chile. We came over as a migrant and grew up in the south in Fitzroy during the 80s and 90s. And so during all that time, I grew up in these very racialized communities where marginalization was, really concentrated in the flats, from a family that was politically active back in Chile. And as I grew up, I kind of got into the social justice space, trying to find a spot for myself. And I went overseas and I worked as a human rights observer in this really interesting project in mostly based in Latin America, where our role was to bring to light the human rights abuses that both governments and private companies were that were occurring on mostly Indigenous people and obviously racialized communities. And that really took me into a completely different place of working, where it was around advocacy, walking alongside communities, showing solidarity, but also doing media and doing all this work that kind of builds a coalition of groups to change some systemic issues. So when I came back to Australia, I tried to find my space in this place, and I really never really found it. And so when I met Tamar Hopkins, we kind of got chatting, and some of the work she was doing in the research space, but also in the law space, and the work that I wanted to do in the community space and the movement building space kind of just resonated with each other. And so we set up this Center Against Racial Profiling, where the work really revolves around challenging systemic racism, challenging police, challenging the state, challenging authority around racism, and trying to really root it out. And we don't pretend to do this on our own. The idea of the center is to build a movement, to help and support build a movement so that we can all be fighting for racial justice through any means that we do this. And so the work we currently do usually has three legs. We have a research arm, we do workshops, and then we do a lot of community development, or what I call movement building. And over the time, we've been able to bring in a few more members. So we now have Priya Kunjan, who's joined us, and also Idil Ali, who's also part of the centre.
Fantastic. So really, it's about raising awareness, isn't it? And I'm hoping that this will grow to include legal support eventually.
Well, yeah, and the idea is to build awareness, build education, but also work from the ground in the grassroots movement to really build a movement and support that movement, I guess. The work that I do mostly is around community development work. So I'm in the communities. I actually work very closely with the flats in Flemington and in North Melbourne, and we're doing a lot of work currently around the relocation and the demolitions of those buildings. But that interacts really closely with policing, because policing is such a visible and reality of the life in those flats. so it's about doing that work on the ground and then bringing that up to the research, so to Tamar, to the researchers, and say, hey, this is what's happening on the ground. Can we get some work done here? And then connecting it to the legal services. So it's a really holistic piece of work. We're really trying to connect all those dots so that we're fighting it on all fronts, really.
Absolutely. Can you let listeners know about the police powers that are happening? Because there's so much going on, isn't there? Oh. I mean, on the one level, we've got the designated police zones,
mm-hmm.
which is quite appalling, which mm-hmm. I think in the end, the whole of Australia will be affected. It'll become a nanny state, sorry to say. Mm-hmm. But also, there's also the protests coming up where the Owen government is bringing in, all these repressive laws. Perhaps we could start off talking about the designated zones and also the shooting as well and what led up to it, because it's connected, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And look, maybe I'll start with the shooting of Abdel
sure.
Fattah in Footscray and then move into the designated areas. So as some listeners may know, Victoria Police murdered a black Somali refugee a few months ago in Footscray. He was a community member who had was well known to the establishments around Footscray, and he was going through a bit of a crisis in that moment. Police rocked up. This is all allegedly, of course, and shot him, and he died on the scene. Now, the police and the Victoria Police narrative is that this was an accident, it was a high-pressure situation, and, you know, the police were in their right to kind of act this way. And so, you know, we were trying to challenge that and say, well, no, there's actually a history behind this. And so we did a bit of research and a bit of digging, and we just connected some dots, which were, so back in 2006, many, many years ago now, there was an operation in Flemington and in the inner west. Right, we're talking about the inner west, this very racialized community. There was an operation called Operation Molto, and it was a secret operation which targeted African men because they thought they were stealing cars. And so the police force were, for a whole month, just raiding Flemington of any black man who was walking around and stopping them, questioning them, harassing them, at times even bashing them. That grew all across the west, and so many, many operations just like it kind of spun off from it. Operation Regnant, Operation Omni, Operation Square. So many of these Victoria Police operations were clearly targeted towards mainly the African community, but racialized communities in the inner west. Now, we moved forward a little bit, so that was 2006 to maybe 2010, and we moved forward a little bit and we start getting into this media frenzy and this moral panic. And I'm sure you remember, Marissa, all this talk about African gangs, the Moomba riots, yeah. The Apex gangs, right? Now, that was a manufactured moral panic. Right, there was this idea of these Apex gang roaming around the streets, stealing cars and whatnot. They did such work, Victoria Police, to make this image in everyone's mind. But just a few years after that, they came out and said, actually, there was no Apex gang. Actually, it wasn't majority African. Actually, we made it up. We didn't realize. Right, but the damage had already been done. This idea of a black African or racialized young person as the image of crime had already been created in the people's minds, especially in Victoria Police. Okay, now we move a little bit more forward. 2016-17. I think you also remember this moment. Milo Yiannopoulos came down to Flemington.
Yes.
Now, Milo Yiannopoulos is still is a far right provoker. Spouting all this racist ideology out through his mouth. And he found a platform here in Melbourne. There was a growing neo-Nazi movement in Melbourne in that time, and there still is. But he came here and did a speaking tour. Now, a lot of venues didn't allow him to speak, except there was one venue in Flemington that allowed him to speak and do his spiel, which was right across from the flats in Flemington. Now, that day, police came out because they knew there was going to be a reaction. They came out and they protected everyone who came into that venue. They stood outside with their riot police gear and they allowed people to go in and out into that Milo Yiannopoulos conversation. And meanwhile, people were outside, you know, protesting this racist, vile, hate speech, really. what happened after that was that community members from Flemington came down to join in that protest. And as the venue was being cleared, as people were leaving, police were actively protecting this far-right and neo-Nazis to leave and go back peacefully back to their home. Meanwhile, they pepper-sprayed and bashed and hit many, many community members. In fact, that night there were reports of the police raiding the houses of many of the people who lived in the flats. It caused an uproar. Now, move forward a little bit more, and we've got the COVID hard lockdown. Again, another targeted racial intervention of massive amounts of police picking out these flats, particularly in the inner west, North Melbourne, Flemington, again, being in the brunt of this policing, and again, being picked out because of their race, because of their situation in society. Now, we would argue that Abdi Fattah's shooting is an exact correlation, and it's another domino falling over from the exact same logic of Victoria Police picking on Black African men and racialized communities in general, and assuming criminality on them, assuming that they are already criminal just for being in a certain place and looking a certain way. And then who cops the majority of the issues and cops the majority of the blame is that community, and Victoria Police can get off scot-free and say that they had nothing to do with it. Now, that is a direct, you know, we did this historical study and said this is, Abdi Fattah's shooting is actually, while shocking, shouldn't be surprising because it falls within the pattern of what Victoria Police already do. I say all of this to say that on Saturday just passed, all of Footscray was declared a designated area, a place where police have extra powers to search people. Coincidence? I'm not sure.
Well, there's never any such thing as coincidence, is there?
That's right.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That was an excerpt from last week's Doing Time show, which airs on Mondays from 4 to 5, talking about incarceration across the continent, where the host Marissa was speaking with Isla Diaz from the Centre Against Racial Profiling. Again, as they mentioned in the interview, be sure to follow them on their Instagram account. It's Centre Against Racial Profiling. Because they are really good in posting when the police declare these designated areas. And now we're going to hear a segment from the Common Social Change Library. Their bulletin called Tiny Sparks and Turning Points, which provides a list of radical events over the years that changed so-called Australia. Which comes to us the first Monday of every month at 8 a.m. or in today's case at 8:04 a.m. Here's the bulletin.
Tiny Sparks and Turning Points is a monthly selection of protests, strikes and significant dates concerning social change in Australian history. This segment is presented by the Commons Social Change Library, a repository of more than 1,500 resources for campaigners, which can be found at commonslibrary.org.
On the 1st of August 1980, public transport users in Melbourne rode free for a day after conductors refused to collect fares as part of wider action against fare hikes.
Huge crowds thronged the streets of Adelaide on the 1st of September 1885 for the annual 8-hour day procession. Starting in King William Street, 2,500 workers from more than a dozen unions bearing banners and accompanied by brass bands, marched to Exhibition Gardens. Upon arrival, a ball and picnic were enjoyed by more than 12,000 people, along with an athletics carnival.
On the 2nd of August 1917, employees in the New South Wales Government's Everly Railway and Randwick Tramway workshops stopped work over the introduction of techniques aimed at speeding up the pace of labour. This triggered what would become a massive general strike across various industries in New South Wales, Victoria, and Queensland.
Also, on the 2nd of August, but in 1974, women and children rallied at Wynyard Station before turning the Sydney General Post Office and Martin Plaza into a protest playground. This was a demonstration against the federal government deciding to defer $130 million in spending on childcare. On the same day, the Women's Electoral Lobby organised a protest against the cuts outside Parliament House in Canberra, featuring a larger-scale kids' party, including a fire engine, carousel, balloons and toffee apples. The widespread campaign led to $75 million in funding being restored the following month.
On the 2nd and 3rd of August 1937, 450 employees of the South Australian Gas Company defied the advice of the United Trades and Labour Council to carry out South Australia's first sit-in strike at Brompton, taking action over the refusal of their employer to restore an industry allowance regarding health risks and obnoxious smells. The workers occupied a disused stokehouse from 8 a.m. Entertained by an improvised jazz band, mouth organists and an accordion player, the unionists initially allowed a skeleton staff, made up of office workers, foremen and others, to perform work before running them off the site around 10 p.m. Following this action and threats by railway and metal workers to widen the strike, the company caved in at 1:30 a.m, restoring the full wage.
On the 3rd of August 1972, students at Sydney's Fort Street Boys' School won the reinstatement of 6 students. These students had been suspended for taking part in a 2-day strike over the issue of male hair length. In addition to overturning the punishment, school authorities agreed to waive hair length rules and end the harassment of student activists.
As part of strikes and protests involving more than 7,000 childcare staff across Australia, workers gathered in Canberra on the 5th of September 2018 to demand living wages and better conditions.
In 1982, the Fraser government pushed through approvals for the mining of uranium at Jabiluka in the Northern Territory. This was consistently opposed for decades by Mirarr traditional owners on a variety of grounds, not least the abrogation of their sovereignty. One of the first protests against the proposed mine outside of the NT took place on the 6th of August 1982 in Sydney when the officers of Pan Continental Mining were picketed.
The 6th of August marks Hiroshima Day, a global event commemorating the 1945 US atomic bombings of Japan. In 1986, thousands of people across Australia honoured the victims by demanding US base closures, a ban on nuclear-powered warships, and an end to uranium mining.
On the 7th of August 1980, Aboriginal people from across the Kimberley region joined with unionists and other supporters of the Nookumbah community's right to deny mineral exploration on their land. Together, they blockaded a convoy of mining vehicles at multiple locations. After mining company AMEX gained access to the site, the drilling crew, all union members, struck over the draconian actions of the West Australian government in removing protesters.
On the 8th of August 1933, 95 members of the Unemployed Single Men's Group of Melbourne were evicted from their homes by a similar number of police. Previous attempts to remove them from 7 terrace houses on James Street, Fitzroy, had been stymied by crowds numbering up to 1,000. Following the surprise attack, the group and supporters marched to Parliament House, where they dumped their belongings on tram tracks. The protest and threats to sleep on their beds in the street immediately forced the Minister for Sustenance to provide the men with new accommodation.
On the 10th of August 2019, members of Extinction Rebellion held a die-in at the Canberra Centre shopping mall to highlight the unfolding climate emergency. This came a day after hundreds of students and staff walked out of classes and offices at the Australian National University with a rally followed by a march to Civic.
On the 12th of August 1979, approximately 100 people opposed to the imminent destruction of rainforest habitat met at Terania Creek. Having spent 5 years employing orthodox methods of lobbying and public submissions to no avail, they spontaneously decided to set up a protest camp. Utilising improvised forms of organisation, consensus decision-making and tactics such as placing bodies, objects and vehicles upon roads and occupying trees, they disrupted work for around 4 weeks. At that point, the New South Wales state government placed a moratorium on logging.
On the 13th of August 1979, the Unemployed People's Union threw a huge party just outside the gates of a Liberal Party fundraiser at the Fancy Wentworth Hotel in Sydney. Despite the presence of numerous police, the 400 unemployed revellers got close enough to give a rowdy welcome to those who had paid $250 a ticket, then the equivalent of 5 weeks' unemployment benefits.
The 9th anniversary of John Howard's rewriting of the Marriage Act to exclude same-sex couples was marked on the 17th of August 2013 with a rally and march in Melbourne. It concluded with a marriage ceremony outside the registry office for those couples who wish to formalise their relationship.
On the same day, 17th of August 2013, the Freedom Flotilla left Cairns for West Papua to support resistance against Indonesian occupation.
From 1855 onwards, the Victorian government introduced a series of discriminatory taxes and laws aimed at isolating, segregating, and driving out the colony's Chinese immigrant community. Each set of measures were resisted via various means, including collecting petitions, such as one tabled on the 18th of August 1857, decrying the racist taxes and, quote, insults and oppressions from the ignorant, the cruel, and the malicious, close quote. Petitioners, including European supporters, called for equality under law.
The federal cabinet gave uranium mining at Roxby Downs the go-ahead in 1983. Activists opposed to the dangers associated with all stages of the nuclear cycle, the massive waste of water in an arid zone, and the abrogation of Indigenous sovereignty shifted gears. In August 1983, hundreds were arrested during 9 days of action at the Olympic Dam site. After a small number maintained a year-long vigil, another major protest was launched on August the 19th, 1984, with the aim of hindering the mine while drawing public attention to it. Around 400 people took part in road occupations, site invasions, street theatre, letterboxing of the mine camp regarding safety issues, lock-ons and a cyclist cavalcade.
On the 20th of August 1934, cane cutters at Ingham began a wildcat strike after employers refused to prevent the spread of Viles disease by burning cane prior to harvesting. Spread by rats, the disease had affected over 170 workers during 3 recent outbreaks, hospitalising many and killing 7.
As part of opposition to fees for higher education, students occupied RMIT's financial services offices on the 20th of August 1997.
The 21st of August 1969 saw an anti-conscription campaign bear fruit after the Federal Attorney General freed draft-resistor John Zarb from Pentridge Prison 14 months early. Having refused to register and then repudiated call-up notices, Zarb had been summoned in October 1968.
On the 23rd of August 1966, Aboriginal pastoral workers and their families walked off Wave Hill Station, demanding equal pay and an end to the intolerable conditions they worked and lived in. The campaign soon came also to focus on land rights. The determination of the Gurindji people and support from unions and others saw the community win back approximately 3,300 square kilometres of their country in 1975.
Campaigning by Queensland unions to restore the basic wage from cuts which had been introduced 3 years earlier culminated in a statewide strike by 18,000 railway workers on the 28th of August 1925. This followed earlier industrial action by seafarers and miners, as well as widespread discontent which had seen the resignation of Labor Premier Ted Theodore. The rail strike shut down transport around the state, and within 8 days the government had capitulated.
On the 29th of August 1939, prison reform activist Samuel Rosenberg ended an 18-day hunger strike protesting New South Wales' use of the death penalty.
On the 29th of August 1977, anti-uranium activists shut down the Ranger Uranium Mining Company's Sydney offices. The occupation was held as part of a National Day of Action, which saw thousands rally across the country against the expansion of Australian involvement in the nuclear cycle.
On the 30th of August 2002, around 2,000 human rights supporters assembled at the State Library in Melbourne. This was to mark the first anniversary of stranded refugees being saved in international waters by the crew of the MV Tampa. The protesters called for freedom for refugees and spoke out against the government's xenophobic campaign of slander against them.
Despite threats from the government to send in 1,000 constables and armed militia to, quote, fire low and lay them out, 60,000 people defied the authorities and gathered in Melbourne on the 31st of August 1890 to support an ongoing maritime strike.
You've been listening to Tiny Sparks and Turning Points. The segment will return next month. In the meantime, to find out more about the history of social change in Australia, you can visit commonslibrary.org.
You're listening to The Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That was, as they said at the end of that bulletin, the Tiny Sparks and Turning Points bulletin for August from our comrades at the Commons Social Change Library. If you do want to read more about events that happened in so-called Australia, about radical history events that happened in so-called Australia, the Commons Social Change Library have set up a page called From Little Things, Big Things Grow, Events That Changed Australia. There's some pictures as well from newspapers that they've taken for some of the events that they mentioned in the bulletin, and we'll be sure to put the link to the webpage in the show notes.
Up next, I'll be chatting with a community activist regarding the demolition, ongoing demolition attempts from workers at the Flemington Towers. Good morning. Are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Morning. Welcome. Thanks for coming on the show this early on a Monday. Appreciate your time and energy.
No, at all.
So, I understand that right now you're on the way to the Flemington Towers.
Yes, yeah, I'm actually heading down there again because I've just heard that a public housing resident of a different set of towers or elsewhere, but a public housing resident has locked onto the drilling rig, the machinery, this morning, and is stopping work for the day again. So going down to support him in doing that.
Yeah, beautiful. Do they have this morning at the towers a Rahu there?
Yeah, I'd say so. I'm not sure exactly. I'm only going to pull up in a few minutes now, but yeah, I'd say the usual suspects. I'd say there'll be some Rahu people are usually down there.
Just quickly for listeners, if you're tuned in, Rahu stands for Renters and Housing Union.
Yeah, and they've been fairly involved, along with a lot of other groups, in trying to stop the privatisation, demolition of public housing. Mm. Rahu will likely be there.
So do you want to provide us and the listeners a little bit more context behind not only the situation today, but what's been going on for the last couple of weeks and months?
Yeah, certainly. I guess it's a campaign that's been going on for some time because it was announced. It was first announced that all 44 housing towers were planned to be demolished like a couple of years ago, I think even 2022 or something like that, when Daniel Andrews was still the Premier.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess it's been kind of simmering away there as a campaign for a while, but it's been ramping up a bit as they've continued to... The state government or Homes Vic has been trying to voluntarily relocate the residents of these towers, starting with particularly these ones in Flemington, North Melbourne and Richmond, the first to go.
Well, I suppose it's nice of them to voluntarily do it first, right?
Well, yeah, I was going to add some context to that. That it's, you know, it's called a voluntary relocation, but and that's what it is in technical or legal kind of terms, because the residents who have decided to move have like signed papers saying so. But the pressure and the kind of like constant harassment to sign these forms in various kind of ways from Homesvic makes it a fairly tenuous type of voluntary. It's the kind of harassment involves, you know, like it's kind of like a lot of these residents maybe have moved here from overseas, don't speak English as a first language at least, and they'll send a Homesvic officer to their door and bang on the door, and kind of it's all very urgent when really that we know that there's no urgency. There's no reason that it needs to be done with a knock on the door and like a personal visit like that. And lies and obfuscations and this kind of thing have been pretty common from what we've heard. And I think just out of fear or not wanting to delve into kind of like the conflict that is kind of happening in terms of the campaign to save public housing, a lot of residents have decided to move, but have been moved much further away from where they're currently living, where the community is here in like Flemington, North Melbourne, Richmond, so on.
Well, yeah, that's part of the problem, right? It's separating these communities. And
absolutely.
Yeah, to kind of come back to pausing demolition works, I believe you locked on last week.
Yeah, I think it was the week before now. It was the Friday before that, the 25th. I came down here, I guess, somewhat like this morning, a few weeks ago, and there wasn't really a picket planned. Me and a friend were just going to do some coffee and tea and try and kind of chat to residents and just be a presence there and also kind of have eyes on if there was any construction works happening around the site. And as soon as we got there, we saw this big kind of drilling rig that I think it takes samples of the soil. And as far as we understand it, that is samples that will help them to understand the kind of underground geology and so on, and know how to build on that site, you know, how they will lay the foundations and that kind of thing. So we see it as definitely being a part of the pre-demolition works that we are taking issue with and trying to stop. So we saw the drilling rig and we chatted to the workers, and yeah, they didn't tell us a lot, but they confirmed it was soil testing and this kind of thing. They said the kind of the site manager there of this like smaller site was fairly was kind of cooperating and saying, "Oh, look, if you don't want us to work, we can stop and we'll just pull out the drill and we'll be done in about an hour. Like we have to depressurize it first." So it sounded like they were just going to pack up and go home because of our presence there. And there was only a few of us, but then perhaps they spoke to their higher-ups and were told, no, you'll keep working. And kind of the police came down and this kind of thing. So it became clear that it wasn't going to be easy to get them to stop work. And then when they tried to move the drill to the next site, just kind of 30, 40 metres away across the car park, a few of us tried to get in the way, and were kind of pretty promptly plucked up and moved out of the way by police. So it was a fairly kind of powerless feeling just with the numbers we had on the ground, and we didn't feel like we were going to be able to do much about it.
I'm sure it would feel quite powerless living in the towers as well and being told to move on.
Yeah, I'm sure that's how many of the residents feel, is that there isn't much option for them other than kind of this voluntary relocation, as I said before. There was some residents there with us that morning, but also just some people from the campaign and the community. The lock-on was a pretty spontaneous idea out of that frustration and feeling of kind of not having any way to stop the works for the day.
It takes a level of, I think, like courage and bravery to put your body on the line, so lots of respect for that. I suppose when like with for the workers, I suppose they don't have skin in the game, but having their bosses contacting their bosses who are always going to push their own agenda, and you know, essentially there's private money waiting, so Yeah.
Yeah, that has been the feeling, is that what we've seen since then as well is that, you know, because there's been pickets in the week that followed the day I locked on. Some of them successful, a lot of them, though, like, we just couldn't sustain the numbers necessary. And, like, with police being there, and they've also, you know, hired security to be on the clock, round the clock, when the workers aren't there to protect the machinery. Just, like, that feeling of the deep pockets they have, and the fact that, you know, the police will be there to help them get the work done has left me feeling a little bit, less optimistic. But at the same time, someone else, as I said, a public housing resident, has locked on this morning and is slowing down works, and it is all costing them money, and it's only one piece of the puzzle. I think, you know, there was also a rally on Saturday morning with a few thousand people there, all coming out to show their support for stopping the demolition and the privatisation of public housing and saving the towers. So, you know, there's a couple of different angles we're fighting this campaign, and stopping the works is perhaps just one little flashpoint amongst that.
Yeah, that's all we've got time for this morning. Thank you for your time, and hopefully this morning goes well. Did you want to put one last community call out over the radio, just for any listeners who are curious about where and when this is happening this morning?
Yeah, absolutely. It's 120 Racecourse Road, kind of closest to the creek there. You should see it. There's a few police cars parked at the front, right next to the 120 Racecourse Road tower. And, Comrade is locked on, and we'll be there for a few more hours at least, I'd hope. So come down, and there'll be coffee, tea, and, it'll be lovely.
Beautiful. Good job, Comrade.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Take care. Thank you.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. It's 8:28 a.m. Which means we only have a few minutes left, so maybe we'll just remind listeners to, as the comrade said at the end of that interview, if you can, please attend 120 Racecourse Road to help comrades out in stopping the demolition works that are taking place there. Pretty disgusting, vile things happening with the privatization of public housing, very neoliberal. Just give a last final rundown of what else we spoke about in the show. At the top of the show, I spoke with Tom Studens, who's an independent welfare rights advocate, whose independent coverage has been recognized by the Robo Debt Royal Commission about the federal court's ruling a few weeks ago that the federal government will need to recalculate more than $4 billion worth of debts owed to the Department of Social Services. Then we spoke with someone about native logging in Lutruwita, the locking on that's been happening there. Following that, we heard a segment from the Doin' Time show in which host Marissa spoke with Arlo Diaz from the Center Against Racial Profiling about the context behind the killing of Abdi Fattah Ahmed in Footscray a few months back. We also heard a bulletin from Common Social Change Library about radical events at Change Australia in August. And the show ended with a live cross to someone who's heading to the picket at Flemington Towers that we just mentioned. And that brings us to the end of the show. So stay tuned for Women on the Line, and we will see you next week.
Ciao.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.